from the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Josh Kranzberg, in for Jason McClure. Every year, a handful of journalists from around the world are selected to be Alfred Friendly Fellows. These journalists are partnered with American news outlets in the hopes that they can learn and help spread U.S. news ideals, namely fair and accurate reporting. We're lucky enough to sit down with them to talk about their experiences reporting and what they hope to get from their fellowships. Joining us now is Amal Khan. She is the features editor at The Nation. She is a Daniel Pearl Fellow and will spend time at the Los Angeles Business Journal and the LA Times. Ms. Khan, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you so much.
So you report out of Pakistan. Things have changed pretty dramatically since 2002 when then-President Pervez Musharraf opened up the country media-wise, allowing private TV channels and FM stations to obtain licenses. More information flowed in the country, but some say the news has become sensationalized. Is that something that you've noticed?
Yes. I mean, first of all, it's one of the many ironies in my country of ironies that it took an unelected military dictator to free the media up. Once that happened, yes, there has been an influx of information, and yes, the media has become exceedingly sensationalized, especially television. There are very few checks and balances. Accountability is low, and yes, it's a bit of a jungle right now, to be honest.
So facts are a bit of a fluid concept.
Yeah, facts are a fluid concept. You know, there is almost close to no verification. Sources aren't checked. Also, ethically, there's just a problem about what we, you know, there are parts of a story sometimes that should just not be told or not be shown, mm-hmm. Without which you can still holistically present an accurate story. And I mean visually disturbing images on television after, say, attacks or a bomb blast, you know, they will have no hesitation in going inside hospitals, you know, honing into the faces of suicide bomb victims. It's really gory stuff. And, you know, because of the sensationalization and because of the 24-hour news cycle and the, you know, the sheer competition now in TV, and even in print, really, there seems to be, you know, very few rules that people are living by, that the press and the media is living by.
So what kind of effect is that having on the viewers and the readers and listeners in Pakistan?
Well, first of all, it's an overload of information. There's so much information coming at you all the time. You don't know what's right and what's wrong. So, you know, selecting truthful, honest information is hard. That's number one. Number two is, and I choose to see this as a positive more than a negative, you have the youth very much mobilized towards information. And you'll see teenagers and young adults listening to, you know, watching television programs about politics very eagerly. And this is something that you did not have while, you know, say I was in college. I didn't know very much about Pakistani politics. Now everything is so heavily politicized and sensationalized. It's kind of gathered in, you know, younger people who would normally not have been interested in the news. They would have been, you know, watching soap operas on television or, you know, something light. But now it's kind of dragged the debate into everybody's living room and into our classrooms. And that's interesting. And because of all that, now we're also having debates and conversations about how to control the media.
Well, speaking of controlling the media, some of the complaints about Pakistan is that corporations are starting to exert their financial power over reporters, over what to cover or what not to cover.
Yes.
Have you experienced that?
Yes. Not myself personally, but somebody who's very close to me has experienced that. She is a journalist. I'm not sure I can say. The details are still very fresh. It's still an ongoing case. But yes, it does happen. It has happened. I hear of it happening. Personally, myself, I have been lucky enough to kind of steer clear of that.
Pakistan is also not really regarded as a very safe place for journalists. One report says a journalist is killed every 38 days. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, 77 journalists have died since 1994. Do you feel safe as a reporter in Pakistan?
You just do your job, you know? You're kind of on autopilot. You don't think about these things. There will be occurrences. You read about them every other day. You report about them every day. But you kind of, you know, you choose to remain oblivious, I suppose, to the risk. But yes, they're very disturbing sometimes. And if you allow yourself the room to sit down and think about what could happen, well, anything could. When I joined the paper, you know, my editor-in-chief outlined the taboo topics, the topics that we should not touch.
And like what, for example?
Saudi Arabia, our relationship with Saudi Arabia is very sensitive. The military, Balochistan, again, is a very, very sensitive taboo topic that nobody really touches in the media. Blasphemy is another one. So these are topics. There are some no-go topics, and then there are some topics that you kind of have to flit around cautiously. There's no fun in that, and honestly, I don't think there's any truth in that either.
So if you were to cover those topics, what are the consequences of that?
I mean, people have been killed, journalists have been shot, they've been incarcerated. The consequences are endless, really. But you know, I will say that this is a very brave, it's a very brave media we have now in Pakistan, and journalists are really taking it upon themselves to uphold honest, truthful reporting.
How hard is it? We've talked about how facts are fluid and how they're trying their best to uphold the honesty. How hard is it as a journalist who sticks to those codes to compete in a media environment where facts can be bent or outright fabricated?
It's difficult, but I think it's kind of a long-term thing, you know. Over time, you will build up more credibility that way, and I think that is the most important thing.
And you think the viewers and readers appreciate that as well?
I think they do. I think, again, what we discussed earlier, because of the overload of information, people are also getting a lot smarter about that information. And if you're too careless in reporting, and if you know you're reporting daily, you're going to get burnt. You're going to do something wrong. You're going to piss somebody off. And sometimes, you know, if you're reporting without ethics, if you're just going after things without verifying any facts, it's going to come up. It's going to show, and it's going to damage your credibility. And in this line of work, your credibility is everything. So I think those people don't last very long anyway. It's you know, people don't have the appetite for that anymore.
So we talked about the dangers reporters face in Pakistan. I would imagine it's exponentially increased as a woman. Do you find it's more dangerous as a female journalist in Pakistan, or is it safer, or how are your experiences?
You see, I am a prisoner of my experience, and I can only speak for myself here. I myself have never faced any discrimination because I'm a woman. Maybe that discrimination is so deeply embedded in my subconscious that I don't even realize it's there anymore. But that being said, I've never acutely felt like a woman when I enter a room full of men. I don't. Yes, it is awkward sometimes. It is uncomfortable. Men usually in the workplace will not know, basic kind of basic etiquette. But by and large, everybody is polite and everybody is kind of cautious about around a woman. She's like this otherworldly being who has entered the newsroom. And especially in the paper that I work for, we have like these relics who've been sitting at the same desk for 50 years, working away. And for them to have, you know, myself, I was younger, I'm a woman, and to come in as an editor, I think it was a bit jarring, but we developed our relationships, and they're great friends of mine, they're buddies of mine, and we have a grand time in the newsroom, we have a grand time at work. I love these guys, and honestly, they've been nothing but respectful, if I'm talking about the journalism community. Outside of the journalism community, it's a bit of a jungle.
I would imagine it doesn't really matter if you're male or female.
It doesn't really matter. Yeah, if you're a journalist, you're
exactly.
Yeah. No.
Have your bosses done anything to make sure you feel more protected out in the field, or just in general?
Yeah, I mean, all intelligent measures are always taken. If we are writing about, or you know, being sent on an assignment, or writing editorials about sensitive topics, they do everything that they can to ensure that we are safe. from, you know, armed guards sometimes to just, you know, kind of guiding us along, letting us know, you know, steer off this information in this way for now. Let's put this in a couple of days when it's... So, I mean, you have to, you kind of have to improvise in Pakistan with journalism. You kind of have to improvise every single day. There are no rules.
Really. Is it unnerving to be traveling with armed guards if you're going to do a feature story on a family?
No. I'm used to it since I was a child. We've just been brought up in this society where it's normal to have, you know, big men with guns around you to protect you. It's really dysfunctional and sad and doesn't always work out, but yeah, there it is.
So going to your fellowship now with the Los Angeles Business Journal and with the LA Times, what will you be doing with them?
Well, the hope is to take back all this extraordinary knowledge and all this technique and to, well, train is a long shot. I mean, I'm still learning. But, you know, to help maybe in my colleagues and just other journalists back home kind of open their eyes to a world outside of Pakistani journalism, which can be so short-sighted because it's so consuming. Sometimes we forget to realize that there's so much else that's that should be incorporated in our storytelling. So yeah, the hope is to improve our efficiency as writers, to improve our efficiency as editors and as storytellers, and really to just go after the honest truth.
Do you feel like there's a bit of a learning curve moving to a Western media outlet, especially as well-respected as the LA Times? Coming from the news environment of Pakistan?
I mean, I don't know. I can't say I haven't been there yet, but I can't imagine it's anywhere near as exciting as being in a newsroom in Pakistan.
How so?
Because everything's happening all the time. You know, there's so much going on and there's so much breaking news every single day, every minute, really, that it's almost hard to keep track of. I don't know. I don't know what it's going to be like at the LA Times, but I imagine it will be much more laid back than the newsroom back in Lahore.
Do you imagine that going to a paper like the LA Times, where the standards are a bit high, are very high? I don't want to say higher, but they're very high. Yeah. Will be a shock to the system. You know, especially after coming from Pakistan, where you said that,
yeah, I think people are going to, you know, dismiss a lot of it as, oh, here comes the young girl who went off to the U.S. and, you know, is here to teach us our job. But I also feel like a lot of journalists now recognize that there's something really wrong in the way that we are telling stories and are willing and open to learn. And I think that it so far my experience has been absolutely enlightening, and I can only imagine that it's going to get better. And I just hope that I can translate that information in a way that is relevant back home. I think that it should be pretty straightforward. And I'm telling you, I have some wonderful people waiting back home to hear all about it.
Well, Amal Khan, thank you so much for joining us on Global Journalist.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Josh Kranzberg, in for Jason McClure. This week, interviews with international journalists who are in America as part of the Alfred Friendly program, which connects them with U.S. news outlets to help the spread of free and accurate journalism. If you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read in-depth articles on international affairs and free press issues, and download past episodes from our archive. We're also on social media. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @GlobalJourn. Our next guest is Olena Goncharova, a reporter for the Kiev Post in Ukraine. She'll spend her fellowship in Pennsylvania as part of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette newspaper. Ms. Goncharova, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you.
So you have been with the Kiev Post since 2012. I found out as an intern. That's a nice first job. Obviously, Ukraine has gone through a lot in just 4 years. Talk to me about your experiences during the Russian annexation of Crimea, the protests, the violence, just all of that.
Well, you know, I still remember this fall of 2016 when it all started as a student protest in Kyiv. You know, people were really frustrated because our then president, Viktor Yanukovych, promised that Ukraine is going towards Europe. And then suddenly we ended up as, you know, getting closer to Russia, which was a little bit of a surprise for a bigger part of my nation. And that's why, especially young people, they felt that things should be changed immediately. And this would be the best thing, you know, to make it to streets and to start protesting, because this is the only way they can change situation as it was back then. And like I said, first it started like student protest, but then it became bigger and bigger, and it grew, and it actually involved so many cities around the country. So we had, you know, different protests, smaller, bigger ones, like say in Western Ukraine, in Eastern Ukraine, basically everywhere. Probably in Crimea, we didn't have that kind of, you know, movement and uprising, because they were like a little bit separated from all these things happening back then. But you know, this was the first revolution I witnessed as Ukrainian, when actually things got bloody and really nasty, when, you know, more than 100 people were killed in Kyiv back in February 2014. That was really heartbreaking to me, because back then I was a student, and again, I was an intern at the Kyiv Post, and I was always like torn a little bit, because I wanted to participate as a student, but at the same time, I wanted to cover the events as a journalist. So you need to keep this balance and to stay objective. It was very emotionally difficult, and I still remember when finally, Viktor Yanukovych fled Ukraine, and we ended up having like acting prime minister and this acting government. And basically, things have been changing so quickly, so rapidly, that suddenly we understood that you know, Crimea is in danger, because all of a sudden there were green men there, you know, messing around the territory, checking the military bases. That was so, I don't know, really, really terrible, because I guess even the leadership didn't know what to do back then. The country was like in ruins, because, you know, our economy was in deep trouble back then. It is still in trouble now, but, you know, we are recovering a little bit. And, you know, I guess the only idea and the main goal was just to, you know, keep things in order. And, you know, if it's the case that we need to give up Crimea, okay, we'll do that. So basically, yeah, we gave up Crimea, we gave up a part of our territory. This wasn't a bloodless, you know, situation, so to say, because a number of Ukrainian soldiers were killed in Crimea in the first days of, you know, this war that started as an annexation. And then we just, you know, we sat and watched as things going bigger and bigger, and we sometimes even didn't know what to do, because so many things were going on. We were totally shorthanded, because we are basically a very little newsroom, mm-hmm. but we need to keep our readers not only in Ukraine but all over the world updated on what's going on. So yes, I remember those times. It was crazy, I should say.
I can't begin to imagine. Going back to you saying it was difficult for you to remain on the journalistic side of things, your Twitter profile says 100% Ukrainian. Talk to me about how hard that was to remain objective, especially that you had, you know, RT, Russia Today, having a very obvious, for obvious reasons, a pro-Russia stance. Did you feel like you and your fellow journalists at the Kyiv Post had to do a pro-Ukraine stance, or was it imperative for you to just have a this-is-what's-happening viewpoint?
Well, basically, our chief editor always says that we should just do our jobs and stick to the highest standards. He often jokes that, you know, we should be a kind of Kyiv's New York Times, Ukraine's New York Times. So that's why, you know, we were reporting on everything that was going on back then. And of course, trying to, you know, keep this balance and try to show each side's, which of course sometimes was quite difficult, especially when we were covering a revolution. Because, you know, you cannot only talk about protesters, you should also talk to riot police, to the representatives of military, to the defense ministry, and that's why, you know, sometimes it was really, really difficult. At the same time, we never were told something like, okay, you should cover this, but you should not cover that. And speaking about Russia today, right now we have another source in Ukraine. It's English language TV channel, which is available online, and it's called Ukraine Today. Well, personally, that's just my opinion. I think that the naming probably is not that quite right, and that they should have come up with something better. But again, that was created just because, you know, we understood that we need to somehow cope with this Russian propaganda, with all that messages that were coming from that side. And sometimes just for us as like a biggest newspaper, English language newspaper in Kyiv, that was really difficult. So it's good that we have other sources that help us, you know, in this information battle, so to say.
Ukraine has fallen pretty dramatically in the World Press Freedom Index, going from 87th in 2008 to around 125 last year. The World Press Freedom Index cites the creation of an information ministry, of hoping to somewhat control or corral the media. So what is it like being a journalist in Ukraine? Do you feel that pressure day in and day out?
Well, I cannot say that I feel that much pressure. And speaking about information ministry, honestly, I think that they could do actually a better job, because sometimes their tasks should have been, you know, divided between other people, between some NGOs who help them, just because, you know, the new ministry was created and nobody knew exactly what was on its agenda, like what's it going to do. Of course, like they stated, okay, we should, you know, we should try to, you know, have broadcasting there in eastern Ukraine. For example, we should have radio stations that Ukrainian fighters can listen to when they are on the front lines. Because again, right now and back in 2016, there were mostly only Russian radio stations available in eastern Ukraine. So I guess, you know, information ministry tries to do something, but it's too little, and of course they need much more people and much more professionals, you know, to help them.
So despite going down in the World Press Freedom Index, you say they're not doing a good job of getting out their message?
No, unfortunately not. Well, you know, in 2015, Ukraine was, I guess, for the first time in top three countries, the most dangerous countries for journalists. Well, obviously, because so many of journalists were like suppressed, or sometimes they couldn't get to the side of rebels, you know, to cover the situation on the ground.
Do you feel safe as a journalist there?
Me personally, yes, I do. Unfortunately, I had no chance to go reporting to eastern Ukraine, but well, I try to do my best, and you know, keep eye on things that going on in Kyiv, because we still have, you know, many different topics to cover.
Of course. Switching gears now to your fellowship. This fellowship, this Alfred Friendly Fellowship, means probably a little bit more to you. The Kyiv Post apparently set up a GoFundMe page to help get you over here, and it took only 19 days to raise $5,000 as part of getting you over to the States. Talk to me about that process and how it feels.
Actually, it was a little bit of a surprise to me, because at that time I was on vacation, and when my chief editor said, well, yes, you know, we'll, you know, create this page, you know, to send you over there to the United States, I thought, oh my God. It's so difficult to raise money nowadays in Ukraine, because we have all this volunteer movement. People try to raise money for soldiers, for refugees. And I just thought, well, who would give money, you know, to send journalists to like study and to train in the United States in these difficult times for my country? So I was very surprised that we actually managed to raise this sum of money so quickly. And, you know, I feel I feel this great responsibility because I should, you know, show my best and learn as much as possible, because then back at home I need to share all my knowledge with my colleagues and maybe with the students. I have a plan to go to J school back in Kyiv and, you know, to tell them about how things going on here in terms of journalistic standards.
Well, that's great. So your fellowship is with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette newspaper. What will you be doing with them?
Well, so far, I want to learn, again, as I said, as much as possible. I want to understand how actually the newsroom operates and what are the tasks, you know, given to certain people, like what the editors do, what are their responsibilities, what do journalists do, whether it's convergent newsroom or not, do they use different, you know, programs or mobile tools, you know, to make their jobs more efficient. Yeah, so that's basically what I plan to see there.
Do you feel like there's going to be a bit of a learning curve or a bit of a shock to the system? Not that you've been suppressed in Ukraine, but the flow of information is a little bit different there than in the United States, where pretty much you can find out anything about anyone and report on whatever you want. Do you feel like there'll be a bit of a shock?
No, I don't think of it as a shock. I think of it as an interesting process of learning. And, well, maybe it's even good that things are not so, you know, hectic here in the United States. So I'll probably have more time to do some feature stories, which I actually like very much. But unfortunately, in Ukraine, we usually are on a tight deadline. So I need to file my stories really quickly here. I hope I'll have a chance, you know, to sit down and think more and to analyze and to look on how other journalists do their daily tasks. Maybe that's the main point. So we'll see. I will have a chance to compare this to totally different situations.
And what do you hope to take back to Ukraine after your fellowship with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette?
Well, basically all the tools journalists and editors are using in their everyday job and the standards, of course.
Well, that'll do it for this week's edition of Global Journalists, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri. Many thanks to Amal Khan and Elena Goncharova for taking the time to talk with us. Global Journalist Studio Director is Travis McMillan of RJI, and our audio engineers Pat Akers of KBIA. For all of us here at Global Journalists, I'm Josh Kranzberg. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.